Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Before the financial crisis and before the flash crash, there was the real thing, Black Monday, 25 years on. You want to know who to thank for the problems we have with China? You can thank Richard Nixon, that's who. And you think you're working too hard? You're probably not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 19th of October, 2012, about which more later. We're going to spend the first four or so minutes of this radio program, though, trying to decipher the past 4 days, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Very Wall Street today. Cardiff Garcia is here from the blog FT Alphaville. Catherine Rampell from the New York Times as well. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, 200 and some odd points on the Dow, which I thought was interesting because there was not a lot going on, actually, today to make this happen. It makes you a little uneasy, doesn't it?
Well, there were a few profit reports that came out. We got numbers from GE, from McDonald's, from Microsoft that were all kind of disappointing. So I have a feeling that investors got kind of spooked by what they were seeing on that front and otherwise extrapolated to the rest of the market.
Cardiff, what do you think?
Yeah, a little bit of perspective here. You know, the market went up a lot in the first half of the week. It went down a lot in the second half of the week, and we're about to where we started, right? But I think Catherine's right. Probably what happened was driven by earnings reports. I'm not worried for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not really a big shareholder in anything. But two, you know, I think this is the result of a couple of things. One is that global growth appears to be slowing, so American companies that sell things overseas aren't selling as much as we'd hope. But another is that they're also not able to cut costs the way they used to in years past. And in some ways, that's actually a good thing, right? It means that they're not firing as many people. So it's something to worry about if you're a shareholder. But in terms of what it tells you about the U.S. economy, I think it's fine.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, with the caveat, Catherine, that the economy is not the Dow and the Dow is not the economy, doesn't the prospect of corporate profits that disappoint mean bad things?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen kind of a split in the last few weeks between what's happening on the business front versus what's happening amongst consumers.
Yeah.
And a number of surveys and other indicators of consumers and consumer spending have actually been pretty good. So despite what these big multinational corporations are seeing in terms of slowing growth, largely coming from Europe and the rest of the world, American consumers are actually looking a little more enthusiastic and a little more upbeat.
All right, Cardiff, let me flip this on its head and take you back to yesterday. This news about Google, first of all, that it posted its profit report early, but most importantly, it didn't make its numbers. So that's Google with a lousy report, Microsoft shares are down, Apple shares are down. I mean, can you say tech bubble, anyone, or no?
That's hard to say right now. I mean, I would probably separate the problems that other companies are having with the problems that these tech companies are having, right? These problems are more a result of an evolving business model. So a lot of people are switching their preferences from PCs, personal computers, to mobile stuff, so smartphones and iPads and things like that. And part of the reason that Google disappointed was because advertisers don't pay as much for the ads that they place online. But you know what? Google has access to this market. And in the long run, I think they'll be fine. Might be a temporary blip. I'm a little bit more worried about Microsoft because what happens on PCs and the software they sell, it's really their bread and butter. So there, it's a little bit harder to say.
You guys are totally like raining on my parade, man. Everything I suggest, you guys are just poo-pooing. So, Catherine, I will actually open the floor. How are you feeling? Let's do the occasional Marketplace Weekly Wrap series that we call Gut Check. How are you feeling? What's your sense of how the economy
about
doing?
The economy,
yeah.
About job growth?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, you know, there are a number of indicators showing that consumers are feeling pretty good about things. And it's taken a really long time for consumers to start feeling more optimistic about the economy. If consumers are feeling better, they start spending more money, that should lead to more hiring down the road. So I guess I'm a little more upbeat than I usually am. I'm usually sort of a sad Eeyore type about the economy, I feel like, when I do the rap. But lately, there have been, you know, some glimmers of hope. I mean, the economy is still growing very slowly, too slowly for comfort. But like I said, there's maybe a silver lining out there, at least if you look at what households are doing.
All right, Cardiff, are you Eeyore or are you Tigger, man? Help me out.
Now, I'm with Catherine on this one. I'm feeling pretty good.
Right.
And to everything she said, I would add what's happening in the housing market.
Things are looking a little bit more encouraging.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think that's related to what she said about consumers feeling better. So with the usual caveats, like you just mentioned earlier about things that could go haywire, and there are plenty of those, I think this is a strong, stable trend, and we should feel okay about it.
All right, we come to consensus, finally, after 4 minutes and 27 seconds. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, Catherine Rampell from the New York Times. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. On Wall Street today? Yeah, well, we talked about that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What do you get when you combine an aggressive entrepreneur with a big idea to change the planet? Well, first of all, you get a whole lot of ticked off climate scientists, but also you maybe get some bigger problems, too. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
We don't know all the details, but according to Jim Thomas, a researcher with the Etc. Group that helped uncover the plan, a California businessman named Russ George
managed to convince a small village on the west coast of Canada to give him a large amount of money to go out into the ocean and dump a large amount of iron.
The idea? The iron would encourage the growth of plankton, which would draw fish and trap carbon dioxide, maybe earning some carbon credits.
So that's basically what he did. He set up a company which went out and dumped iron in the ocean.
And in the process, apparently violated international agreements about ocean experimentation and geoengineering the environment. Andrew Parker is from the Harvard Kennedy School.
Perhaps most important to me is it contravened the spirit of the international agreements, which is the spirit that this really controversial area of research, if and when it does go ahead, it should be transparent. It should be subject to public oversight.
George also crossed a whole lot of scientists. Kenneth Cole is a professor at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. He's been studying the potential of seeding the oceans with iron for years.
I'm a little dismayed that the finance and the entrepreneurial spirit has gotten way ahead of the science on this topic.
He says there are potential and not fully understood risks to this sort of geoengineering. And he worries that the public outcry over the project could jeopardize good science in the future. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
I'm not a betting man by nature, but I do feel pretty safe in saying that during the presidential debate on Monday night, foreign affairs being the topic, remember, we're going to spend a lot of time hearing about China, how it's a currency manipulator and a trade rule breaker, and how cracking down on Beijing will help create American jobs. It's a given that China is a force to be reckoned with in the global economy now. But we and our presidential candidates wouldn't even be having these conversations were it not for one particular street in Shanghai and what happened on it in 1972. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz is back now with another installment of his series, The Street of Eternal Happiness.
40 years ago, President Richard Nixon stood beside a helicopter on the south lawn of the White House. He was going on a trip.
We must recognize that the government of the People's Republic of China and the government of the United States have had great differences.
Nixon was headed to the Street of Eternal Happiness. That's where he and Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai would sign the Shanghai Communique, the first step in opening up trade between the United States and China. They signed it here, Street of Eternal Happiness number 175, the Jinjiang Hotel, an old brick building that looks the same today as it did decades ago. Qiu Huanxi was 24 years old back then. He worked the hotel's service counter, a job that paid him $4 a month.
Back in the early 70s, the rooms at the hotel were really cheap, 20 cents a night. It was the middle of the Cultural Revolution. Most of our guests came from other communist countries like Albania, the Soviet Union, and North Korea. The Jinjiang was the only hotel in Shanghai that could handle a big presidential visit like that one.
Cho says he was lucky to have a job. The campaigns of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution had put China's economy at a standstill.
At the time, Mao had a slogan called Dig Deep Holes and Hoard Grain. We had to dig bunkers where we would stockpile food to prepare for war and starvation.
The bunker underneath the Jinjiang Hotel was a special one reserved for Mao himself. Suffice it to say, in 1972, life in China was different from life in America. The number one song in the U.S. when Nixon left for China was this sappy little number.
No, I can't forget tomorrow when I think of all my sorrow.
Now compare that to this chart topper in communist China the same year. In the weeks leading up to Nixon's visit, China's government broadcast this song over and over. It went like this. The east wind is blowing. The war drums are sounding. It's not the people who fear American imperialism, but American imperialism that fears the people. Catchy and daunting for the first presidential visit to China ever. The pressure was on, and it showed. Nixon started the trip at the Great Wall, where he took a look around, turned to his Chinese counterparts, and shared this shocking observation.
I think that you would have to conclude that this is a great wall.
Nixon's trip could only get better. It did, once he arrived to the Street of Eternal Happiness. In footage released by the Nixon Library, Zhou Enlai toasts Nixon and his wife at a banquet in the Jinjiang Hotel. Zhou Huanxi and the other waitstaff were awestricken by what they were witnessing. They stood nervously at the back of the room, unsure of how to act toward the American guests.
Our superiors told us not to be overly friendly to them, nor overly cold. We had to keep our distance. At one point, an American journalist turned to the hotel barber and said, "In the U.S., we can protest a visit by a foreign president. We're very democratic. What do you think of Nixon's visit?" The barber answered, "The leaders are negotiating, but the people of our two countries are friendly." What a fantastic answer. His name was Wan Guoqi. I'll always remember him.
Later on, as Cho and his colleagues corralled the journalists into the press conference room, Cho says his boss gave instructions to serve tea to the African-American journalists first, an effort, says Cho, to show solidarity with another group suffering discrimination under the American imperialists. Cho says there are a lot of things he'll never forget from that week. Nixon's room service order, sand plate chicken, fried shrimp balls, and fresh mushroom with broad beans. Pat Nixon's coat, bright red, says Cho. Above all, Cho never forgot Nixon's words that night, delivered after the signing of the Shanghai Communique.
If we can find the common ground on which we can both stand, where we can build the bridge between us and build a new world, generations in the years ahead will look back and thank us for this meeting that we have held in this past week.
Cho says he feels honored to have played a bit part in history.
Chinese people remember only a few U.S. presidents, but Nixon is our favorite. He threw off the airs of being an American. He came here to our China, and he and Chairman Mao changed the world.
Cho says it's amazing. He grew up as a young member of Mao's Red Guard, targeting America as the enemy. Then he helped host Nixon at the Jinjiang Hotel, ushering in a new era of relations with the U.S.
China and the U.S. are on the right track now. We can go to the U.S. and study and do business. I've taught my daughter we all need to contribute to Sino-U.S. relations.
She's listened to her dad. She's grown up now, speaks English, and she works for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, doing her part to bridge the trade relationship between the two countries. And now, 40 years later, the chorus of that sappy breakup song sums up the economic relationship between the U.S. and China well. The country's leaders may have spats here and there, but our economies are intertwined and codependent. From the Street of Eternal Happiness in Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace. Well,
I can't. How about that song, man? I mean, come on. Check out pictures and video that Rob took all up and down the Street of Eternal Happiness. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
The traditional rectangle bookcase, as one might visualize it, has really evolved into a more decorative piece.
Go ahead, blame the e-book. But first, Let's do the numbers. So here you go. The Dow Industrials fell 205 points, 1.5%, closed at 12,343. The NASDAQ unplugged 67 points, 2.2%, 3,005, 3005, the number. The S&P 500 lost 24 points, 1.2%, finished at 1,433. For the week, the Dow inched up by a 0.1%. Cardiff Garcia was right. Look at that. The NASDAQ fell 1.3%. The S&P 500 gained 0.3%. A couple of big bellwether stocks had not-so-great earnings. McDonald's scraped off 4.5% today. General Electric flickered down nearly 3.5%. Another bad day for tech stocks, as I was mentioning. Microsoft powered down nearly 3% today. Cisco Systems and Apple both raised more than 3%. Citigroup down more than 3% as well today. Bond prices rose. All that money out of equities had to go somewhere. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Attention turns to Boca Raton, Florida for the third and final presidential debate. Yahoo is scheduled to report third quarter earnings. And 50 years ago, President Kennedy announced the discovery of Soviet missile bases in Cuba and ordered a naval quarantine of the island. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we said earlier, not a great day in equities. The Dow off 200-some-odd points. But you know what? Count your blessings, because 25 years ago today, 1987, the Dow closed down 22.6%, the biggest percentage loss by the blue chips then or now, 3,000 points in today's money. I'd love to say we learned our lesson, but I can't. Here's Dan Bobkoff.
25 years ago, John Herzog was on the trading floor of his firm Herzog Heine Gedold when the floor fell out of the Dow.
Every phone ringing, every trader screaming.
Herzog's father had always warned him that 1929 could happen again. And that day, that's how it felt.
The fear and trembling that comes into your stomach when you experience something like this is something that you cannot forget.
Most experts say the 1987 crash was caused by a few things. Interest rate squabbles with other countries, the rise of computerized program trading, in something called portfolio insurance, a way of hedging bets. Things are not too different today, says Professor Richard Silla of NYU. Derivatives and other strategies have taken the place of portfolio insurance, and computers do even more of our trading.
I think that this is a problem for Wall Street. It hasn't really taken to heart that the computers can cause more problems than they solve.
Remember the flash crash 2 years ago? That's when computer trade spurred a short-lived market tumble.
Wall Street, the program traders, the exchanges, should also be questioning some of the assumptions that go into trading strategies today.
It was on Black Monday that trader John Herzog thought we'd see fewer crashes if people understood the market better. He decided to create a whole museum on finance to help reach that goal. But
I think we can always see a crash like that again.
In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
The next time you hear somebody complain they're working too hard, you just go ahead and tell them to shush. The Labor Department is out with a new study that shows people who claim to work 40 hours a week are actually clocking in at 37. Yes, completely respectable, absolutely. But the thing is, back in 1930, John Maynard Keynes predicted we'd all be working 15 hours a week by now, 1-5, that gains in productivity and technology would give us more leisure time than we knew what to do with. John Quiggin is an economist at Queensland University in Brisbane, Australia, and he's got a new piece out explaining why we're not there yet, that 15 hours a week. Professor, good to have you with us.
Good to be talking to you.
So why aren't we at 15 hours every week yet? I mean, I could use that.
Well, it's a good question. For most of the 19th and 20th century, a lot of the progress in terms of improved productivity was taken in the form of increased leisure. People were working incredibly long hours in the 19th century. That got cut back and cut back. But starting with the US and proceeding elsewhere for full-time workers, really that decline in working hours stopped around 1970, and for many workers it's actually been increasing.
Keynes wasn't making this number up, was he? I mean, there were actually formulas that he said, well, if our productivity increases by this much, we'll be eight times as well off and all this. I mean, this is actually quantifiable.
That's right. And Keynes sort of thought with reasonable technological progress, we could reach the 15-hour week or its equivalent by now. The problem really is we're not moving that direction at all. We're taking the increased productivity in the form of more consumption.
Right. That's actually a good point. We are consuming at a rate that there's no way we could work 15 hours and have the consumption and the lifestyle we do.
That's right. We're essentially, consumption levels have risen quite a lot. And for the employed section of the workforce, we really haven't seen any more progress or very little progress in the past 30 or 40 years to increase leisure, even though, of course, material living standards have improved very substantially.
I wonder, though, if it's not possible that we are, in fact, being more productive with technology, but we're also wasting more time.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it turns out that a lot of the things that are most valuable really didn't come from hard work aimed at making money. For example, if you look at the internet, it really, especially in its early stages, arose because university professors liked to chat to each other. That was really the core of the internet. You know, it wasn't sort of driven by the thought that you can make spectacular sums of money.
So here's the acid test, and I'll ask you the question, and then I'll give you my answer, if you like, after you fess up first. But would you, if you won the Australian lottery, would you quit your job?
No. So I guess, but on the other hand, I have a job that really isn't very distinct from what I do otherwise. I'm a researcher. I like writing my blog, and I like researching. Some of it I get paid for, and some of it not, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes my wife crazy, but I would keep my job if I won the lottery.
That's true. I think if all jobs were like that, then it wouldn't be such an issue. But, of course, if you're driven by money, you end up doing jobs you don't like.
Yeah. John Quiggin is a professor of economics at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. He's written an article recently about Keynes and his 15-hour work week. Professor, thanks.
Thank you.
The publishing industry is in some trouble, as you know. The rise of digital books, the long, slow decline of the printed word. And what about the shelves we use to store all those printed words on? How's that industry doing? Marketplace's Mark Garrison is on it.
We're in the Chelsea storefront of Beau Concept, a Danish modern furniture brand. Think far nicer and pricier than IKEA, but not $10,000 couch pricey. There are plenty of sleek, beautiful shelves on display, but you'll only see a handful of books on them because that's not how customers use them.
The book isn't the first, second, or third thing that they would put in it.
Shoko Cheng and his wife own several Beau Concept stores in the New York area. He says his clients are more likely to use shelves for holding TVs, DVRs, framed photos, and art objects. But the decline of physical books hasn't changed much about furniture manufacturing. Henry Long is a senior VP at Hooker Furniture in Virginia. He says bookshelves can puzzle his younger staffers.
They wondered why we were still coming out with bookcases when everyone had iPads and Kindles. The fact is, we still sell a lot of bookcases.
Long says he's seen a decline in his very largest bookcases, but people still need shelving. It's just different shelving, says veteran furniture designer Jenna Hall.
The traditional rectangle bookcase, as one might visualize it, has really evolved into a more decorative piece. Some of them are asymmetrical. They have unusual configurations of shelves.
But even the most digital homes will still have some books, at least for decoration. You can see what e-books will never replicate at the famed Manhattan bookstore, Strand. Poke your head into its offices and you'll see books everywhere, on carts, on tables, desks, and yes, bookshelves. The place is fragrant with an aroma of pages printed lifetimes ago. Jenny McKibben shows me the room where they fix old leather volumes.
Books are work of art. I mean, all of these antique leather bindings you see around us, individually handcrafted and made by bookbinders, and there's so much art that goes into it.
McKibben works with interior designers and set decorators to find the right books for their spaces. She can create a library with books of whatever subject, size, language, and color you want. Good condition antique leather books go for $400 a foot. You can get 12 inches of cookbooks for $125.
I think there's just always going to be a demand for the physical book. I mean, for an aesthetic point of view, there's something tactile about a book.
Books on a shelf make a design and personality statement that even a digital native won't deny. So bookshelves aren't dying. They're only changing as people use them differently. And even if they're called wall units or shelving systems instead of bookcases, there will still be books there, the ones most beautiful and meaningful to their owners. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the state of Minnesota is cracking down on free online education, out-of-state online learning in particular. The Chronicle of Higher Education reported this week that Minnesota officials have told online learning companies they're not allowed to teach state residents unless they get a license from the state, which comes with a fee attached. In other words, no free learning unless somebody pays. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow off 205 points, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ unplugged 67 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 down 24 points, 1.75%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money.
All those things in the Fortress of Solitude, which includes, for example, a giant solid gold key so heavy only Superman can lift it, suddenly he would have to pay taxes on that, and that's a lot of coal to crush into diamonds.
Hey, Superman needs some spending money too, you know? I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.